Is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Siegel, Judge Ross, the Honorable Judge James Flory presiding.
Right. Good morning, everyone. This is the first case is court file A20-0199 Wat Lau Suri Thamaram versus Mark Sathong et al. Here for oral argument today. Just a couple of preliminary comments. We've been having a little bit of a sound issue this morning, so I want to make sure everyone can hear me. So can you give a wave or something if anybody's having difficulty hearing me now? Nobody? Everybody can hear me just fine?
Yes.
Great. All right. So thank you for appearing via Zoom here today, and hopefully our audio problems are behind us. Both sides here will have 15 minutes for your preliminary arguments, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. Otherwise, everything should proceed as it would normally proceed if we were all in person. The only thing I would caution you, and perhaps the you've already been cautioned about this, is when you're not speaking, if you can have yourself on mute, that seems to work best, because then we're not hearing the rustling of papers or anything like that. So with that, we will begin. And counsel for appellant, or both counsel, if you would identify yourselves for our record, please. As you begin your arguments, that would be most helpful. And I'll remind everyone that our rules prohibit the recording of these proceedings other than by the court. We are making a recording and we'll post them on our website as we normally would. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Mark Olson. May it please the court and counsel. I represent the appellants in this matter, who are former directors of the plaintiff corporation, having acted in that capacity from 2014 up until the decision in this matter in October of 2019. Findings of fact shall not be set aside unless clearly erroneous. Findings are clearly erroneous where they're manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence or not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole. Findings are clearly erroneous if the reviewing court, when looking at all the evidence, is left with a definite firm conviction that a mistake has been made. Finally, evidence supporting findings has to be reasonable evidence. This case has a rather odd history to it, involving five separate cases that overlap to one degree or another. I would submit to the court that if judicial estoppel was recognized in Minnesota, this could be the poster child for judicial estoppel. The respondent's position changed after 3 years of litigation, shortly before trial, a position that completely altered what they actually pled in this case. And as the court is aware from reviewing the record, Judge Miles issued a decision in, I'm going to refer to it as case file 3673 in Washington County, in February 2018. That decision resulted in the dismissal without prejudice of an action that had been brought by the respondents in the fall of 2017. The basis for that dismissal was a determination by Judge Miles that the bylaws of the corporation had irreconcilable conflicts with the articles of the corporation. Based upon that determination, which later turned out to be incorrect, in fact, the articles were not legitimate articles that had been submitted by the respondents. And there are numerous questions regarding the actual bylaws themselves that I'll get into in my short period of time here. But the respondents brought this current cause of action based on that determination. Immediately after that determination, the respondents filed documents with the Secretary of State's office alleging that a board had not been chosen by the corporation prior to February of 2018. And we would submit with the volumes of evidence of the record, that position is completely unsupportable. But in any event, they went forward on the basis that the bylaws were legitimate and that directors had not been chosen by the corporation. That position continued all the way into December of 2018 when it was discovered the articles that had been filed with the Secretary of State's office, in fact, were not legitimate articles. And in fact, the legitimate articles had no conflicts with the bylaws. Once that was determined, after 2 years of litigation, the respondents changed their position entirely, and their attorney said during summary judgment arguments in December of 2018, we don't know where these bylaws came from. We don't know if they were ever legitimately adopted or anything else. That position had never been taken until it was determined that the actual articles had not been before Judge Miles. Now, fast forward to this appeal. At page 6 of the respondent's brief, the respondents assert that the joint statement of the case that had been filed little more than a month before trial correctly identified the case that they had pled in this matter. It didn't correctly identify the case that had been pled. And the fact of the matter is there was no amendment of the complaint. And the case proceeded as allegedly pled in their complaint. But once we got to trial, Ms. Christina Vallee, one of the respondents in this matter, testified that she didn't know where these bylaws came from. And in fact, gave extremely conflicting testimony. She also testified that there was no board of directors. That position was 100% contrary to an affidavit she submitted in case file 3673 in September of 2017. In that sworn affidavit, Christina Vallee stated unequivocally, in fact, in a rather braggadocious manner, that she had made sure there was compliance with the Minnesota statutes, that she had made sure that she followed the rules required by law, that she was responsible for the creation of the initial board of directors, and in fact, that she and respondent Pong Mali were both directors. That issue was raised before the trial court in response to a summary judgment motion in December of 2018 as well. Counsel at the time for the appellants raised the issue to Judge Freeman in this case and said, well, wait a minute here. How can they be taking two inconsistent positions? The one position, there was a board of directors, the other position they're now taking to suit their facts and to suit their claims, there never was a board of directors. There never was one created. There was never one authorized by the incorporators. And therefore, the respondents had the right to create this alleged new board in February of 2018. That is just the tip of the iceberg when you look at the record, because there are dozens and dozens and dozens of references by the respondents in their pleadings, not only in this file, but in previous files, to the board of directors that allegedly did not exist, to the bylaws that allegedly had never been enacted by the corporation, even though their attorney in the eviction action in the fall of 2017 told two judges that the bylaws were legitimate, ask two judges to rely on those bylaws and allowed both judges to render decisions on the basis that they were legitimate bylaws. None of the respondents objected to that. And in fact, an affidavit submitted by the respondents in conjunction with the eviction proceeding, as well as the file 3673 proceeding, they clearly and unequivocally stated that the bylaws were to be followed. In fact, they filed a petition in December of 2017 that relied entirely on these bylaws that they would later claim didn't exist. So, in one of the points,
let me ask you this, Mr. Olson, yes. Because it's not at all clear to me what record you're talking about as you're making your argument here. Are you talking about the trial record that was presented to the district court at the bench trial in this matter, or what? Because it seems to me the court made its determination in this case and its ruling based on the record that was presented at trial. And you seem to be spending quite a bit of time here talking about records or filings in other court files. So it's a little unclear to me what you are talking about when you talk about the record in this matter in terms of determining whether there were clearly erroneous findings.
I'm talking about the records from all five cases that are referenced. The reason I'm talking about that is at the commencement of this case, in order to shorten up the process, Judge Freeman said that parties did not have to submit all of these other documents and records from all these other case files, that she would take them into consideration. That's an expansion of what would typically be judicial notice of other matters. However, both counsel present at that trial agreed that the court could proceed in that fashion. And therefore, the court indicated it was going to take into consideration all of the files and records in all of those other matters, which placed them before the court in the trial that took place in July of 2019. So we've got all this other evidence. We've got, in fact, again, as I stated, if you just narrow it down to the present case, there is evidence in there that references the documents specifically from the other files that Judge Freeman said that she was going to consider in her determination of this case. So it's not strictly the testimony and the exhibits that were submitted during the trial of the matter. She said she was going to consider all of these other documents and records. That's what I'm referring to.
Okay. If I can interrupt just for a minute. Sure. So how do you respond to the judge's determination that your clients were not legitimate directors? I mean, what is the remedy you're seeking if what you're saying is correct, and why under our state statutes? Is that right?
I think based upon legal concepts such as ratification and whatnot, this court can issue a determination that, in fact, these directors were legitimate directors without going back to the trial court. Remand is always possible, but I don't think it's necessary because I think there's a sufficient record that these people, these gentlemen, acted as directors for 4.5 years. The respondents walked away from the corporation, left them in charge and control. There is Minnesota law that says by doing so, the existing president at the time became the president of the corporation. So I think there's sufficient evidence in the record for the court to say that these individuals were in fact proper directors for the corporation, and that the respondents were not, because their positions as incorporators terminated back in 2010. And if they didn't terminate in 2010, they terminated in the very least in 2014 because the respondents had not created a board within a reasonable period of time. But in any event, I think the record is extremely sufficient to demonstrate that, in fact, these are legitimate directors and that they should, the decision of the trial court should be reversed, and the decision should be that they are the legitimate directors of the corporation. That answers your question. All right.
So based on that, then, do you agree that the original one-page article of incorporation that was filed with the Secretary of State back in, I think, 2010 was the original documents that legitimately created this corporation?
I do. That's according to the corporate record. It's stamped by the Secretary of State's office. We have no reason to doubt it. My clients weren't involved with the corporation until 2014. Ms. Valet had total control of everything up until that point in time. So, yeah, we do contend that those are the legitimate articles, that one-page document. And getting back to this issue of what transpired along the way, Ms. Valet, from 2010 to 2014, apparently acted as the only person acting under the guise of being a director. We don't know if one of the other incorporators was ever involved. He was listed as a registered agent. Respondent Pong Mali came and went. When he came back, he recognized the authority of this board of directors that consisted of my clients. He did so by sitting on that board. He did so by submitting affidavits that recognized the authority of the board. Ms. Valet was out of the picture at that point in time, but according to her testimony, she was still involved with the corporation. She never objected and said that they weren't a legitimate board. So you've got two of the original incorporators ratifying the fact that they were legitimate directors and acted as so up until.
Yeah, that was my timer. Your time has been up for some time, Mr. Olson.
I'm sorry.
I'll let you finish your comment and then we'll go to Ms. Hunt.
All right. I just wanted to accentuate the fact that in 2011, Ms. Valet filed papers with the Internal Revenue Service saying that there were, in fact, bylaws and directors had been appointed by the corporation. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Hunt, you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nord Hunt, and I represent the respondents Wat Lao Syria Tamaram, Christina Valet, and Tong Di Pong Mali. Now, this case comes before the court following a bench trial. I just want to comment that respondent's position is fully in accord with the complaint that was filed in this case, particularly if the court looks to count Roman numeral 3 declaratory judgment. The question essentially posed in this bench trial to the trial court is, who constitutes the corporation's board of directors? Appellants argued to the trial court that presented a fact question for the trial court's resolution. The trial court, as finder of fact, found appellants were not the board of directors. Respondents Valet and Pong Mali, along with Mr. Hewson, are the corporation's board of directors, and respondents request affirmance. Now, appellants admitted in their closing memorandum in lieu of closing argument, there was no evidence that anyone here had breached any kind of fiduciary duty. The trial court, in making its determination, assessed the credibility of the witnesses, determined the weight to given their testimony, and made findings of fact. And as this court is well aware, this court views the evidence in a light most favorable to those findings, indulging every reasonable inference in support of that finding. Now, at trial, appellant's argument was based on Trial Exhibit 42, which stated premise was that there was no board of directors before an April 20th, 2014 meeting. The trial court found that defendant Tham Vong, who claims he was on April 20th, nominated and elected to serve as the first chairman of the board by respondent Valet, contradicted himself because he stated he was nominated and elected to be a director by a majority vote of 30 individuals present at an August 2013 meeting. The trial court had before it Ms. Valet's testimony that she denied she ever nominated or somehow elected defendant Tham Vong. The trial court found respondent Valet as one of the three incorporators did not have actual authority to elect or appoint Tham Vong as a director or chairman of the board. And the notion that Tham Vong became a director based on reliance on apparent authority, which is also a question of fact, was rejected by the trial court. I found that respondent Valet exercised no apparent authority at that April meeting. As the trial court concluded, there was no board of directors until the amended articles of incorporation were filed on February 21, 2018, which designated Valet and Pongalmi as directors until they appointed or elected a board. The trial court, based on the record, concluded that the board of directors is comprised of Pongmali, Valet, and James Hewison by reason of the action of the incorporators on February 25th, 2018, and respond and seek affirmance of that ruling.
So, now, Ms. Hunt, how do you address appellant's argument that the record in this case is actually much broader than what was submitted at trial based upon the trial court's indication that it would take judicial notice of all the filings and these other tangentially related matters involving these parties?
Appellants really are mistaken about what it means when a court takes judicial notice of a court file. A court cannot notice pleadings or testimony as simply true because the statements are filed with the court. A court can take judicial notice that a party made a statement contained in a court file, but it cannot take judicial notice of the truth of that statement. So what we have here is, if you look at the record, so we have a bench trial. Both parties were free to utilize at that bench trial documents to cross-examine the witness. And appellants did so. So they specifically cross-examined respondent Valet utilizing her September 15, 2017 affidavit filed in 3673. If the court looks to pages 131 and 132 of the transcript, you will see that the appellants cross-examined respondent Valet on her previous affidavit testimony as to her participation in the temple after 2014, specifically addressing paragraph 5 of that affidavit. But that's the only portion of the affidavit on which appellants chose to cross-examine respondent Valet. It wasn't for the trial court then to sit there and ferret through everything that was filed, and somehow that goes into how it makes its determination. It gave counsel full leeway to utilize at the bench trial and use it in cross-examination or for impeachment or whatever. And ultimately, the trial court did as it does in every bench trial. It made its findings. I just want to comment that appellants argue the fact that there was no board of directors until 2018 creates some kind of problem, but it doesn't, because Minnesota Statute Section 317A.165 takes care of that problem, which says the doing of a lawful act is not invalid because the corporation was without power under the chapter, articles, or bylaws to do so. And the properly constituted board can obviously ratify that which has occurred, which would be in the best interest of the corporation. As to the issue of the incorporators not acting within a reasonable period of time, that wasn't raised as an issue at the bench trial. But what the statute says is that the court can grant equitable relief in an action commenced by members with voting rights or by the attorney general We have no members with voting rights, and the Attorney General did not intervene here. Everything was taken care of to get the corporation in its proper good position on February 25th, 2018, appointing the first board. So that satisfies the statute. So any issue of non-compliance is moot. Mr. Olson did not argue about his other issue, which was the denial of a continuance, but that's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. There is no abuse of discretion here. Withdrawal of counsel doesn't create a right to a continuance. Appellants obtained a new counsel. Before trial, he presented a motion in limine. He amended witnesses and exhibit lists. There was cross-examination of the witnesses. And like I said, even utilized document from 3673 to cross-examine Valet. And so there was no prejudice. So what we have here is simply, we have had a bench trial. We've had the trial court listen to all the testimony, make credibility determinations, and make its determination. And based on this record, there is no clearly erroneous finding of fact, and the findings of fact support the conclusions of law. So respondents respectfully request that this court affirm the district court.
Got to unmute. So you're giving up the remainder of your time at this point, Ms. Hunt?
Your Honor, unless the court has some questions of me with regard to the record or respondent's position, I think the case has been thoroughly briefed and that the trial court's findings of fact, as I stated, are in accord with the record, that they're not clearly erroneous and fully support its conclusions of law.
All right. Seeing no questions, we'll go to you, Mr. Olson, then for your rebuttal, if you wish.
First of all, with the issue of continuance that I didn't discuss before, if you look at how this case was tried and presented to the trial court, if you look at the extensive history of this matter, and all of the activities that went on in all these other cases, a real estate attorney simply could not try this case adequately. And I think that was demonstrated by the case was presented at trial. The counsel talks about the fact that he cross-examined Ms. Valet. I think there's 17 pages of transcript where the appellant's trial counsel actually cross-examined any of the respondents. I agree that the mere withdrawal of counsel does not grant one the right to continuance, but that's not the only factor involved in the grant of continuance. The issue of prejudice, I think it's clearly demonstrated here by the fact that this particular attorney could not get up to speed in time to try this case. There was a short continuance requested by my clients. They asked for a 60-day continuance. They had not asked for a continuance before that. There was no prejudice demonstrated by the respondents to that request. And I think if you look at the record as a whole, if an attorney who knew the record tried the case, there would have been a completely different outcome with the trial court. As to statute 317A.171, I disagree with counsel's assertion that issue was not raised at trial. Fact of the matter is, in post-trial submissions made by their quote-unquote expert who acted as an attorney submitting an opinion, Mr. Plunkett, he referenced 317A.171 a number of times in his affidavit. And you don't get to the conclusion by the trial court without going through 317A.171. And finally, with regard to who can utilize that particular statute as far as the reasonableness standard, there's no restriction there that only members with voting rights or the Attorney General's office can raise that challenge. As to the issue of apparent authority that was rejected by the trial court, that was unquestionably before the trial court, I would note that the findings by the trial court are contrary to the law. One in particular is that Ms. Valet, as an incorporator, was the principal. That is 100% contrary to law. She cannot be the principal. Only the corporation can be the principal. The corporation acts through its agents. She was under, any way you look at it, she was an agent for the corporation. Am I beyond my time?
No, you have a minute and 45 seconds.
Sorry. I'm not seeing the clock again. Therefore, her analysis of the apparent authority issue was based upon an incorrect legal determination that Ms. Valet, as an incorporator, was the principal when she was not. So therefore, the arguments presented by the appellant's counsel at trial were consistent with the law. And the court should have recognized the apparent authority that Ms. Valet had in April of 2014, when there was clearly a board created, which is demonstrated by the fact that this board signed off on the mortgage that was obtained shortly thereafter, that Ms. Valet told the mortgage company that the board was authorized to act on behalf of the corporation. These gentlemen, at least four of them, signed personal guarantees for this mortgage in the capacity of directors. So there was apparent authority here, contrary to what the court found. And we would ask that the trial court be reversed, Your Honor.
Mr. Olson, I have a, I didn't want to eat up your time with this. I guess this is just a suggestion for future reference. I had a really hard time, and I guess you should know it, in sort of understanding your arguments in your brief. It seems to me that this is a case that largely hangs on whether the district court's fact findings are clearly erroneous or not. And so when I am reading your brief and trying to figure out what exactly are the clearly erroneous findings that you're asserting, I get to a page in your brief that says there are a bunch of clearly erroneous findings and you've got to figure it out by looking elsewhere in the brief. And then they're scattered around in the brief. I have a hard time following your argument in that regard. And it's just a suggestion for organization's sake that you specifically identify on appeal what are those clearly erroneous findings that you're challenging, rather than having a heading that there are clearly erroneous findings and the court can go looking for them elsewhere in the brief.
I think we did identify at least four of them that were clearly erroneous, and then reference the fact that we brought post-trial motion referenced more than 20 findings that we challenged. We had 1,400 words.
No, I understand. I'm just, if for the sake of an appellate brief, it just helps if we can go to the brief and see what exactly your challenged findings are, rather than being directed to elsewhere in the record and different parts of the brief. It's just a recommendation for the ease of reading and review, and nothing more than that.
And I've done many of these, and unfortunately, this was extremely complicated and hard to put together in a concise format.
Sure, understood. Thank you.
And the time has expired. So the court thanks counsel for your briefing and argument in the matter. We will take the matter under advisement at this time, and we will issue a decision within the statutory period. We stand adjourned on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you.